We're starting a new sermon series tonight. We're going to be studying the book of Esther. So I invite you to turn with me to Esther. Esther is found right after the book of Nehemiah and just before the book of Job. So if you get to the book of Psalms, just go back to Job and then go back one book and you're at Esther. So tonight we're going to be looking at the first chapter of the book of Esther. Listen to God's holy and inspired word. Now, in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces, in those days when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the capital, in the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him, while he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. And when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rods and marble pillars, and also couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels, vessels of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. And drinking was according to this edict: there is no compulsion, for the king had given orders to all the staff of his palace to do as each man desired. Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcas, the 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown, in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, delivered by the eunuchs. At this, the king became enraged, and his anger burned within him. Then the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure toward all who were versed in law and judgment, the men next to him being Karshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Maris, Marcina, and Memucan, the 7 princes of Persia and Media, who saw the king's face and sat first in the kingdom. According to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti, because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus, delivered by the eunuchs? Then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the officials, "Not only against the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also against all the officials and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, 'King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come.' This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media, who have heard of the queen's behavior, will say the same to all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. If it please the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be repealed, that Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus. And let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, for it is vast, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike. This advice pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, and to every people in its own language, that every man be master in his own household, and speak according to the language of his people. This is the word of the Lord. Well, the book of Esther is our new focus over the next couple of months, probably. It'll take us to get through this book, and it's a very entertaining book, as you can, I hope you can see already. It's a pretty easy book to read, and there's quite a bit of humor in it already, and a lot of irony, something we've been seeing in John's Gospel. John uses irony a lot. Well, there's a lot of irony in Esther as well. Now, the book of Esther was written to explain the origins of the Feast of Purim. Purim is a feast in Judaism that celebrates the deliverance that takes place in the book of Esther, a deliverance in which God saved his people from the threat of annihilation when they were threatened by a very powerful enemy, by the Persians. Esther is a book that shows how God's purposes for his covenant people cannot be thwarted, not even when our enemies have all the power and we have no power, because that's the situation for the Israelites in Persia. Their enemies had all the power, they had none, and yet God preserved them. And the story of Esther also reminds us that God, whose name is never mentioned in the book, God often works in hidden ways. God is nowhere mentioned in Esther, but he is everywhere present. Now, the events in Esther take place a little more than 50 years after the Persian king Cyrus issued his decree that allowed the Jews to return to Palestine and rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. And while a number of Jews returned to Palestine at that time, there were many others who stayed behind in Persia for a variety of reasons. Maybe they had gotten comfortable there. Probably that was the situation. You know, I don't know about you, but I don't like to move. I hope I never have to move again. The only time I want to move is when I'm being taken to my grave, you know, being carried out. Just carry me out. And that'll be fine. Let my kids deal with the mess in the basement. That'll be fine with me. So I can certainly identify if that was the reason why these Jews didn't want to leave Persia. But unfortunately, you know, there was a spiritual motive for getting back to the Promised Land, and it doesn't necessarily speak too highly of those Jews who decided to remain behind when they could have gone back. Maybe their priorities weren't quite right. And we're going to see that the heroes in the book of Esther are flawed heroes. There are questions that come up about the two key heroes, human heroes at least, in Esther. There are questions about Esther, and there are questions about Mordecai, her guardian. The odds were not in favor of these Jewish exiles who remained in Persia. The odds were not in favor of them being able to maintain a distinct religious identity in this kind of a situation. The Persians tried to assimilate people into their culture. And that's, you know, usually the case. You know, usually when outsiders come into a culture, you try to assimilate them and get them into the melting pot. But in the book of Esther, we see that God preserved His covenant people. He protected them, He preserved them by providentially guiding the course of events that unfold in these chapters. And this is the first part of it here in chapter 1. God's hand is behind this. And He actually exposes the king of Persia and shows that the king is maybe not as powerful, not as wise as he thinks he is. So the book of Esther begins by introducing us to the king of Persia and then describing the circumstances that set the stage for what takes place in the rest of the book. In Esther's day, the Persian Empire was ruled by a man named Ahasuerus. And Ahasuerus was also known by his Greek name, which is Xerxes. And Ahasuerus reigned in Persia from 486 to 465 BC. So almost 20, or just over 20 years. And the description of his kingdom in this chapter really places a strong emphasis upon his greatness, especially the first half of the chapter. He ruled over a huge swath of land, stretching from India, which in this context it actually would refer to modern-day Pakistan, to Ethiopia, which would be modern-day Sudan. So still a very, very large swath of land. His dominion was divided into 127 provinces. And the writer tells us that Ahasuerus' magnificence was put on display during this period of celebration. And the writer says that Ahasuerus showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days. Now, this celebration was held in the third year of Ahasuerus' reign. And we might wonder, well, why did he wait? Why not? You know, usually when a president gets inaugurated, they have their inaugural ball that night, right? They don't wait 3 years to have their party because then they only got one more year to be in office, right? You know, so why wait? Well, the celebration didn't take place right away because Ahasuerus had to deal with some significant uprisings when he came to the throne. There were uprisings in Egypt and in Babylon when he came to the throne. And he had to squelch those. And the festivities described here were held to celebrate how he had succeeded in doing that. He had put down those rebellions. And what a celebration it is. I mean, just look at the way it's described here in the first 9 verses of the passage. It's stretched over a 6-month period. And then it culminated in a week-long feast for a huge crowd. So the idea here is there's the 6 months in which Ahasuerus is putting all of his royal treasuries on display for people to see. People could come in and look at all of his great wealth and just fawn over him and what a great king he was. And then at the feast itself, the decor is very, very opulent. I mean, they're sitting on golden and silver couches. I've never seen a golden couch, have you? I mean, and they're drinking out of golden cups of different kinds. And then the writer makes special mention of the fact that the royal wine flowed freely. This is the sort of thing that the vast majority of people in the Persian Empire would not even be able to imagine. You know, they didn't have TV in those days, so they couldn't have even seen it depicted. You know, they'd just never seen anything like this. But for the privileged few, life at court was extravagant, especially at times like this. Now we might wonder, well, why did Ahasuerus do this? Why did he host this celebration? Why did he let people drink all of his wine? Although he drank quite a bit of it himself, as we'll see in just a moment. Well, it wasn't because he was generous or kind-hearted. There was another factor that was motivating him. He was just about to start a new military campaign against the Greeks, and he wanted to drum up support for that military campaign. And he wasn't successful in that military campaign, by the way. You know your history. You know that the Greeks supplant the Persians as the superpower in the Mediterranean world. And so the Persian Empire is not going to last. It's not going to overtake the Greeks. But just keeping this in mind, this helps us, it tells us something about what kind of a man Ahasuerus was. He was a man who knew how to get what he wanted. He was used to getting what he wanted. He, in this situation, he's using his riches to convince people of his greatness and that it's really pointless to resist him. He's impressing upon them that it was in their best interests to go along with whatever he wanted them to do. Now, there's just one other detail in the first part of the passage that tells us something about how far Ahasuerus' authority extended. And I think that this is part of the point that the writer is making here. He really wants us to see the extent of Ahasuerus' authority. In verse 8, the writer tells us that the drinking at this feast was according to this edict. There is no compulsion. Now, what does that mean? What's going on there? You know, the drinking was according to this edict. What's going on? It almost sounds like the opposite of what you would hear at a frat party, right? You know, drink as much as you want, you know, or maybe it's kind of like that. But it's, I think the idea here is that the king had so much control over his subjects that a special edict had to be issued in order to give them the freedom to drink as little or as much as they wanted. Otherwise, they would have to drink whenever he drank. So they could only drink as much as he drank or as little as he drank. So his authority even extends to the amount of alcohol that his subjects are going to consume. And as we see in the next part of the passage, he did a lot of drinking over the course of those 7 days. So the key point that we need to see in verses 1 through 9 is that Ahasuerus was a man of immense power and prestige. He was a man who was accustomed to getting exactly what he wanted. It's a picture of man at the pinnacle of success. And when people reach that point, when people make it to the top, they begin to think very highly of themselves, don't they? They have little tolerance toward anyone or anything that gets in their way. But the events that unfold in the rest of this passage show us that Ahasuerus' power is not as impressive as it may seem at first. He's set up to look great here in the first 9 verses, and then the rest of the chapter shows that he's really a nincompoop. Ahasuerus doesn't know it, but there is an infinitely greater king ruling over him. And unlike Ahasuerus, the purpose and will of this king, this great king, the one true king, his purpose and will cannot be opposed. And will not be opposed. In fact, he is able to work out his purposes even through Ahasuerus' stupidity. Well, that brings us to the next paragraph, verses 10 through 12. And in this paragraph, our writer tells us that the heart of the king was merry with wine on the 7th day of the feast. Well, what does that mean? His heart was merry with wine. I think you can read between the lines there. He was drunk. He was drunk. And that in itself is significant. That in itself is something worth noting. For all that the first paragraph has to say about Ahasuerus' majesty and his power, here we see that he doesn't even have the ability to control himself when he gets himself drunk. And that creates all kinds of problems for him. His lack of self-control resulted in a situation that was really utterly humiliating for him. And that's what we see unfold in the rest of the passage. So he's in his drunken estate. He's surrounded by all the fineries of his royal treasury. And he decides, wait a minute. There's one more treasure that I have that I haven't put on display. And who is that? Or what is that? It's a person. It's his wife. It's Queen Vashti. Queen Vashti, we're told, was a beautiful woman. She was lovely to look at. And the king wants to hear his subjects compliment him on the fact that he has such a wonderful trophy wife. You know, that's what he's doing here. He's trying to put his wife on display. And so he orders the eunuchs to go and fetch her from the feast that she's hosting so that she can stand before him and display her beauty and her royal splendor. But as you can see, Vashti is not about to submit to this. She is not about to subject herself to the humiliation of being leered at by her husband's subjects. And so she refuses. She says, no, I'm not going to come to your feast and allow you to put me on display. And of course, predictably, the king is enraged at her response, her defiance. And there's considerable irony in how this unfolds here, especially in light of the first part of the chapter. You know, Ahasuerus is so great. He is so powerful. And yet he cannot compel his wife to do what he wants her to do. You know? So he's being made fun of. His kingdom stretches from India to Ethiopia. It's divided into 127 provinces, but his authority is being defied by someone in his own household. And he is flummoxed by it. He doesn't know what to do about it. And that brings us to the third paragraph, the last part of our passage. Here we see the king consulting with his counselors to determine how he should respond to such an outrage. After Ahasuerus asks them what is to be done to Queen Vashti, one of the counselors responds by pointing out that this matter is even more serious than the king may think. Not only has Vashti defied the authority of the king, I mean, that's bad enough, right? But not only has she done that, she has also set a precedent that women throughout the kingdom are likely to follow. Once the ladies of the land hear about how Queen Vashti put Ahasuerus in his place, what are they going to do? They are going to do the same thing to their husbands. Husband says, cook my dinner, and they're going to say, no, I won't cook your dinner. Yes, there's more irony here. You know, again, Persia is this great kingdom. But here we see the most important and most powerful men in the kingdom shaking in their boots. Why? Because they are terrified by the prospect of revolt in their own household. They can't rule in their own households even. And their response to Vashti's actions exposes the grand flaw in how they think about power and how they think about authority. You know, they think that they have more power than all the peoples around them, although the Greeks are going to prove that that's not the case. But what they fail to see is that there are some things that cannot be controlled by sheer might and by sheer force. Certainly the Bible teaches that men have authority, husbands have authority over their wives, of course. That's true, but how are they to exercise that authority? Not in this way. This isn't going to work. Now, the sword, or physical force, can be used for some things. It can be used to stamp out uprisings in Egypt. That can work if you have enough swords, if you have more swords than your enemy. But a society isn't going to last very long if you try to use the sword to bring your wife into subjection, right? You're not going to have a society for very long. So, again, more irony here. Now, after hearing this counsel from his advisors, the king likes what he is hearing. And this, again, shows us his folly. This is bad advice, but he's going to go along with it. He decides then to issue a decree. And the decree announces that Vashti is being deposed from her position as queen and that she will be replaced by somebody else, somebody who is more worthy, somebody who is better than she is. Now, in one sense, Vashti's punishment fits her crime. She refused to come when the king summoned her. And now what does the passage say? It says, let her never come before the king again. She will never come into his presence again. This is basically an edict of divorce. She's not his wife anymore. And as you can see, this is written among the laws of the Medes and Persians so that it may not be repealed. So this is once the king issues this decree, that's it. There's no taking it back. So it seems like it's a fitting punishment, and yet it's a decision that the king quickly regretted, as we learn in the next chapter, the beginning of the next chapter. It says, after these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. And he remembered how beautiful she was. And he's a lonely guy now. You know, he doesn't have a wife anymore. Now she's gone. So that's part of the folly there. But also, it gets worse than that. Ahasuerus' decree also addressed the broader crisis that was created by Vashti's defiance, or at least the perceived crisis by the counselors. The decree says that every man should be master in his own household. Now, we're going to put an end to this household rebellion. We're going to make a law, and that law is going to say every man shall be master in his own household. That'll teach those women. Well, let's think about this law for just a minute. It might sound impressive, but how in the world are you going to enforce such a law? What are you going to do? You know, the husbands of Persia can try to lord it over their wives, and maybe they'll be able to intimidate their wives into submission to some degree. But guess what? They will never have their hearts. They will never have the hearts of their wives. And so once again, the writer is drawing our attention to this king's foolishness and really his impotence. As great as he may seem, he really doesn't have any real power. He has the power to make laws, but he can't compel people to obey them. Now, there's one other thing to note about this law Ahasuerus decrees. It does the exact opposite of what the king intended. Now, why did he issue this law? What was the whole point here? Well, he wants to save face. He's trying to reassert himself. He's trying to ensure that his people will still respect him and hold him in the highest regard, that this sort of thing won't become a precedent for other wives in the kingdom. But what happens is that by publishing this law, and again, remember, the writer tells us he publishes it in all 127 provinces of his kingdom. And not only that, he gets it translated into the languages that people speak in those 127 provinces. So that every single person in his kingdom is going to know about how Vashti humiliated him. Isn't it ironic? The irony is so thick, you could cut it with a knife. Well, as I mentioned at the beginning, God is neither seen nor mentioned in this chapter. He makes no appearance anywhere in the book of Esther. And that's significant for us because really it's the same for us. This is reflective of our experience in life. God doesn't make appearances. We don't see God. He doesn't intervene in our affairs in observable ways. God is invisible to us, just as He is in the book of Esther. But this passage and this book reminds us that God's invisibility does not mean that He's not present, nor does it mean that He is not at work. God was clearly at work in this passage. He was orchestrating events in such a way to pave the way for Esther to become queen of Persia. And He would then work through Esther to deliver His people from the threat of annihilation. I hope that over the course of this study, of this book, we'll see that the message of Esther is so relevant for God's people today, so relevant for us today. Listen to these thoughts from one Old Testament scholar. He says, "The book of Esther is for those times when the forces arrayed against us seem all-powerful, when to laugh may be the only way to stay sane. But this is not to whistle in the dark or to pretend that things are other than they are. It is to clothe ourselves with the truth that God is sovereign, and to be reminded that He is always with us, even when He seems most absent, and that nothing can ultimately thwart His purposes. It is to affirm that God is our deliverer, and to share in the laughter of heaven." Now, there are many forces in the world that are far more powerful than we are. There are economic forces that could just squelch us. There are political powers that could bring us to a very quick end. Ahasuerus' power was so great that he could have exterminated an entire race of people if he saw fit to do so. And things were in place for him to do that. And we can be thankful, of course, that we don't live in a time and place in which we're targeted in that kind of way by the powers that be. Now, of course, there are Christians in the world today who are targeted in that kind of way, who are subject to persecution because of their faith in Christ. And, of course, our own situation could change very quickly along those lines, and we need to be prepared for that possibility. But whatever our situation is, vis-a-vis the powers that be, we always need to keep things in proper perspective. And I think that the advice of that Old Testament scholar is really a good way to keep things in proper perspective. To learn to laugh. To learn to laugh at earthly power when it's appropriate. Of course, we show respect, but we also learn to laugh at earthly power, joining in the laughter of heaven in appropriate ways. I was reminded of how C.S. Lewis talks about this in his Screwtape Letters. He talks about how the one thing the devil cannot stand is to be made fun of. And Lewis did a very good job of that in Screwtape Letters. Martin Luther did a pretty good job of it too, and that was another point that he liked to make. Was poking fun at Satan. And, of course, the world in its alignment with Satan fits into that as well. So we shouldn't take earthly power too seriously. We always need to remember that no matter who holds power on the earth, the Lord has set His King on His holy hill. Jesus is that King. He is our King. We're a part of His kingdom. And there's no opposing His kingdom. There's no opposing His will. Those who set themselves against his kingdom, what are they doing? Well, they're doing something that is infinitely more foolish than what Don Quixote did when he took his lance and started charging at windmills, if you've ever read that story or if you're familiar with that. And he was nuts, you know? And that was a foolish thing to do. Well, to set yourself against the Lord's anointed one is infinitely more foolish. The one who is seated in the heavens laughs at all who oppose him, just as he laughed at Ahasuerus. This passage and this book teaches us that the plans of even the most powerful earthly rulers are thwarted all the time in all kinds of ways. But the purposes of our God will stand forever. Amen.